Journey Church is a community and movement, a fellowship of discovery. We desire to love well and serve often, while together we explore the adventurous love story of Jesus.
My name is Jamie, and I serve as one of the pastors at the Journey Church. If you are brand new or have been following our podcast for years, thanks for inviting us into your life. I pray that God has used our story and the teachings here at Journey to guide you and to bless you. We, as a church, are in a time of transition. The factory, our home for most of the last decade, has new ownership and new vision, and our church is not a part of that vision. So sometime soon, we will be transitioning to a new home. Would you pray with us as we search for a place to gather and to serve? We're super excited about the adventure, and we're looking forward to what God has in store for us, but we have a whole new set of financial challenges. If you felt loved and served by Journey, would you consider serving us at our point of need? Either through tithing or one-time gifts, your financial support will help us continue to exist as a church that serves not only the local community, church planting initiatives, international missions, but people like you around the world who have found Journey to be a bit of a home away from home. You can easily give by going to journeyfranklin.com and clicking on the Give button located on the top right-hand corner. Thank you again for making us a part of your life. Well, thanks for coming out this afternoon. I know what Nathan said. Like, football is just, it's a thing. But it is a thing. You know, culture, you respond to some of the things that are happening. Now, some of you, it's not really a thing at all. Let's do a quick survey. How many of you are rooting for the Panthers tonight? Okay, how many of you are rooting for the Broncos tonight? How many of you don't care at all? How many of you are hoping Full House will come back soon? Okay, wow, they beat the Panthers. Isn't it coming back like Fuller House? Is it or something? I heard. Is it happening already? Am I 2 weeks? Oh, see, I'm up on things. Okay. Well, I thought tonight, you know, in light of the gridiron and this kind of recognition that, you know, on a day like today, we are recognizing that our modern day warriors are taking the field. I thought maybe we'd do an action adventure story on courage. Are you good with that? So it's a little action adventure. Now I got to set this up. So this is a story from the Old Testament. It's tucked away. I'm going to venture to say you probably haven't heard a lot of messages on this story. It's a very interesting story. It's a little graphic. I'm just going to read it. I won't try to elaborate much. So keep in mind, I'll be reading the biblical text. But when you hear the story, I've reminded you this often. But remember, this book is not just a bunch of rules and regulations. It's an anthology of stories. And it's written in a literary form. And so the authors have taken time not just to report on what has happened in the things of God, but also to write with their own style and creativity. And so the author who's writing in Judges, as he tells this story, he tells it in kind of a satirical form. There are moments in the story that are meant to be humorous. Now, we don't understand, you know, we weren't living in the day in which it was written, so some of the humor may be past us. You might be like, did a middle schooler write this story? Because there's some bad humor in it. But first of all, it's a great story on courage, but it's also a great reminder that the Bible is also funny. Anyway, I thought this will be a great one. So here we go, Judges chapter 3. I don't know how many of you guys did. How many of you grew up with the flannel graph things? Did you? Wow, we're old. How many of you have no idea what I'm talking about? That's cool. That's great. It was like, just picture like a fuzzy flannel thing, and you had little Bible characters that stuck. It was before Velcro. It's like a pre-Velcro thing. And you moved them around. It was in the 70s. I would say all my life I never had a flannel graph, Velcro, or digital childhood story on Ehud, but it's fun. Once again, the Israelites, this is Judges chapter 3, verse 12. Once again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and because they did this evil, the Lord gave Eglon, king of Moab, over power over Israel. Now, catch this opening line. Once again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Now, for those of you who are not super familiar with the Israelite story in the Old Testament, it's a story of God continuing to come to a people, tell them that they are special, offer them wonderful promises of how he would care for them, love them, just like a father would, a good father to his child. But over and over again, the Israelites get distracted, get afraid, forget God, and often just flat out rebel. It happens a lot in their story. This is one of those times. And so God often in his sovereignty would let another power come in and oppress these people that he loved because he knew something had to happen to get their attention. In their willful rebellion, he allowed someone else to teach them a lesson. This happens over and over again in their story. Verse 13, getting the Ammonites and the Amalekites to join him, Eglon came and attacked Israel, and they took possession of the city of Palms. The Israelites were subject to Eglon, king of Moab, for 18 years. So you have kind of this 18-year spread. Imagine, you know, going back into the, you know, early 90s or late 80s, and like from then till now, we've just been oppressed by another nation. Another, Canada just suddenly got really powerful, teamed up with Mexico, and they took over the U.S. for 18 years. So you have a little bit of a feel. So what happens now is, you know, from the lakes of Minnesota to the hills of Tennessee, we're paying tribute to the Canadian and Mexicans. We're saying, you know, well, you took over the country, so they're taking a not just a 30% tax rate, now it's a 60% or 70% tax rate for us. We're having to pay to the Canadians and to the Mexicans because they have taken over, they're ruling the country, and that's just the way it is. And what's happening kind of in the meantime is, you know, again, to put it in our context, we would be ignoring God, giving ourselves over to idolatry. That's what happened with the Israelites. Well, one guy, for whatever reason, and perhaps repents because he's old enough, so he was probably involved at least at some level, goes, hey, this worshiping idol thing, it's not working. And I remember that God called us to come in and to overtake the enemy and to embrace, to move into the promised land. So this king is an evil king who is oppressing and blaspheming God. And so there is this call from God to remove him from power. Like I said, God's allowed him to come in, but it's not God's desire. It's not his intention. His intention for Israel is to be free, to possess the land. So this one guy says, I want to do something about it. You kind of even get the impression that he talks to some of his buddies, like, hey, like we should raise an army and stand up against the king. And like, well, we kind of have an army, but nobody's super motivated to, they'd rather just pay the tribute and nobody wants to fight. And but yeah, but what about the promises of God? Yeah, like we're kind of comfortable, like we're good. And so you get this impression that he goes, all right, I'll do this on my own. And so here you see an act of courage. And watch with this guy, he's certainly clever, but there's something else I want you to see take place in this story. And there's another story that's only a verse long that we'll come back to in a moment as well. But there's two themes in both stories. This one that's several verses long. It's, I don't know, about a dozen or so verses. And then the next story is one verse long, but here's the theme. Watch the limitations. All right? So, again, the Israelites, verse 15. Again, the Israelites cried out to the Lord, and he gave them a deliverer. So somehow God initiated, he gave this courage to this man, Ehud, a left-handed man, the son of Gera, the Benjamite. The Israelites sent him with tribute to Eglon, king of Moab, and now Ehud had made a double-edged sword about a foot and a half long, which he strapped to his right thigh under his clothing. Pause for just a second. So he's left-handed. Let's say a few things about, how many left-handed people do we have in here? Left-handed people, look, what's up? Me too. So in the old days, we were thought to have been cursed. It was not a good thing to be left-handed. Everything from like, it's cursed or real bummer for you, because you're you don't belong. You're a misfit. As a matter of fact, in the old days, when someone would make a sign of peace, they come out with a gesture of their right hand and hold their hand open. This was a sign of peace. And then over time, it turned into this and became a handshake. So that what we now have as a handshake is the modern version of a sign of peace. I'm not coming to slash your throat. Hi, nice to meet you. That's just kind of the modern version. But in those days, you put your right hand out. As a matter of fact, left hand was even dirty, and it was used for dirty things in an absence of a world without toilet paper. So the left hand was the unclean hand, the right hand was the clean hand. So being left-handed was typically not looked on with great admiration. You were peculiar. It would be even fair to say if you were left-handed, you were discriminated against. Now, there was one clan in particular that, for whatever reason, and it seems to be a militarily strategic reason, trained some of their men to be left-handed, to take a sling. They were called slingers, like David and Goliath slinger, take a sling and be able to chuck a stone left-handed. And they worked it out that if they were left-handed, they might be able to attack differently with a different strategic element in warfare. And that was the tribe of Benjamin. So there were these guys who were left-handed, but you kind of get the impression they would be the brunt of jokes. They certainly are not highly impressive. And that plays out in this story because here comes this man, Ehud. He's coming to see the king. And what you'll find in just a minute is he's allowed entrance into the king. And he assumes that there's a certain way the security guard will check him as he comes in. So he takes a sword and he straps it onto his right thigh. Because he's left-handed, he could reach in, he would pull that sword out. So when they come and frisk him, he extends the right hand of peace. There's like, okay, there's nothing under, you know, your clothing. And there's not a whole lot of attention paid to this side, and he knows that. Of course, there's still a big risk. You know, he's still got to go to the king's secret service. But somehow, he walks in, they allow him, and he's coming with his tribute. And it's representing this, you know, group of people. So he makes his sword, he straps it on. He presented the tribute, verse 17, to Eglon, king of Moab, who was a very fat man. I go, well, that's a little cruel. This is where it starts to get very middle school, quickly. When the Bible says that here, what it's referring to is he is extremely obese, but there's also beyond the obesity, there's this implication that he is a glutton, that he is a hoarder, that he is lazy, and perhaps even gullible and naive, because he spends most of his time sitting around eating. And what you get, remember, and I tell you this a lot in Scripture, you typically get in any great story, you get these a foil, who's like sometimes a villain, but or the contrast of good in the story, and then you get this protagonist. So you have quickly this, like, here's a guy who is lazy, gullible, and then Ehud walks in, and here's a guy who's a bit of a misfit, he's peculiar, but he's clever, and he's courageous. So you quickly get this contrast emerging in the story. Verse 18, after Ehud had presented the tribute, he sent on their way the men who had carried it. So he walks in, he's got men carrying tribute, you know. I'm sure there was food involved, or it could be gold, silver, it could be whatever. He comes in, he presents the thing, you know, okay, great, thank you, this is nice. And then all the guys put their stuff down, and Ehud says, you guys can leave. So they leave. It's just Ehud, the king, and the Secret Service. So after Ehud presented him, he sent the men away. In verse 19, at the idols near Gilgal, he himself turned back and said, I have a secret message for you, O king. So at some point, he acts like he's leaving, and he turns around and he says, king, I have a secret message, but it's a secret. Like, it's a secret. And so the king is clearly like, oh, I like secrets. So the king says, quiet, and all his attendants leave him. Which is probably not a good idea for the king, but he does. It works. Ehud then approached him while he was sitting alone in the upper room of his summer palace and said, I have a message from God for you. Now this, there is a lot of double entendre in this. This would be like when you watch an action movie or whatever and somebody says, I have a message. I have something for you. We as the viewer are like, oh, I know the something's not really the something that it appears to be. That's what's happening. He says, I have something for you. I have a message from God. And it's true. It is a message from God. It's a judgment. This is the book of Judges. Ehud functions as a judge.
As the king rose from his seat, Ehud reached with his left hand, drew the sword from his right thigh, and plunged it into the king's belly. Even the handle sank in after the blade, which came out his back. Ehud did not pull the sword out, and the fat closed in over it. Then Ehud went out on the porch, and he shut the doors of the upper room behind him, and he locked them. So he assassinates the king, and you get an idea of how large the man is, to the point that you can't even really tell from the front of him. You're like, well, there's nothing wrong, until you check out his back, and there's a blade sticking out. But he goes to the front door, and he locks them, so he buys himself some time to escape. He goes out on the porch, and, you know, he doesn't tie bed sheets, but somehow he gets out from the porch. Verse 24, after he had gone, the servants came and found the doors of the upper room locked. Now, you have to, this is where I say this is, there's an author who's thinking about what he's writing here right now. So he, you know, you could just wrap up the story there, but the author's like, oh, I'm having too much fun. So I got to tell this. So all his servants said, oh, he must be relieving himself in the WC. He must be relieving himself in the inner room of the house. The Hebrew term here is he must be covering his feet, which is kind of interesting to me. So guys, if you just, hey honey, I have to go cover my feet for a moment. I don't know how it works, but that's the just a little Hebrew. So they waited to the point of embarrassment. Like, has he got the runs? I mean, what do you think? I mean, I don't want to just, you know, I don't want to barge in. But when he did not open the doors of the room, they took a key and unlocked him, and there they saw their lord fallen to the floor dead. While they waited, Ehud got away. He passed by the idols and escaped to Sirah. When he arrived there, he blew a trumpet in the hill country of Ephraim, and the Israelites went down with him from the hills, with him leading them. And this happens a lot when you strike the head of the, you know, the brain dies, and in this case, the absence of leadership means the armies don't know how to function. Well, they're waiting to get their directives, and in this case, they don't. Follow me, he ordered, for the Lord has given Moab, your enemy, into your hands. So they followed him down, and taking possession of the fords of the Jordan that led to Moab, they allowed no one to cross over. If you're a military person, you understand probably what's happening here. They go, they take the fords, so you can't cross over the river. They trap the army. At that time, they struck down about 10,000 Moabites, all vigorous and strong, and not a man escaped. That vigorous, that they're making a point here, they're well-fed. So again, you're getting this contrast of this kind of picture of abundance. And here's the picture that in this story that's emerging. You have one guy who's a personification in this moment, Ehud, and you have the Israelites who have little. There are great limitations for them to function or succeed. You have Eglon, the king, and his people, well-fed, vigorous, and strong, full of abundance, and yet somehow, while they have all the benefits, they lose. So to put this in kind of a sports analogy, you have the Yankees, who have all kinds of money, all kinds of talent, and then you might have the Kansas City Royals who come, don't have the same level, don't have the same benefits, don't have the same resources, but somehow win the day. And that's what's being displayed in this story. Somehow the people that seem to have so little somehow come out on the winning side. That day, Moab was made subject to Israel, and the land had peace, not for 18, but for 80 years. The courage of one man in the midst of his limitations changed the course of his nation's history. 80 years. So almost the rest of this century, imagine, oh, the United States gained its freedom back, and for the rest of the century, we were free. Now, there's one more little story, and again, it's brilliant writing, because it just, you're like, what? 31. After Ehud came Shamgar, son of Anath, who struck down 600 Philistines with an ox goad. He too saved Israel. And that's it. We're done. Next. And moving right along. Like, Oh, I mean, the author's going, oh, I got to write something about Shamgar too, because he's a bad dude. So, yeah, by the way, Shamgar, like, he struck down 600 with a long, like, spear. Now, it was interesting. I read a little bit on Shamgar because I thought, this is interesting too. What's the story with this guy? Some people say he may have been a warrior and he just kind of used this ox goat. It was just kind of his choice. Some people say he was a farmer. But what you clearly get is you got a guy with a long spear, probably not an ideal situation to fight 600 soldiers. But somehow this guy wins the day, and the implication certainly is that it's through the power of God. And here's the deal. It's almost like the writer is saying, all right, you got this big story on Ehud, like that's pretty wild, right? Okay, in case that you missed it, I want to drive home the point. Another guy with a spear took out 600 people. In the midst of his limitations, in what was a less than ideal situation, somehow he won the day. If you have a journal, pull it out, or a phone. I'm going to assume a lot of you have one of those. Because I want to ask you some questions, and let's make this a little interactive tonight, all right? The Bible's telling us something about our limitations and something about the power of God. So let's start with this. What has been for you life's greatest limitation? Just respond. Just write that down. What has been for you life's greatest limitation? You might write, financially, it has always been a struggle. I have a physical disability that keeps me from. I have a learning disability that has kept me from. What for you has been life's greatest limitation? I picked this thing up in my family of origin, and I have this propensity in me toward rage, toward anger, toward alcoholism, toward greed, toward lust. This has been, to this point in my life, life's greatest limitation. I feel so frustrated by this thing. What is it? Now let me ask you this question. How is this limitation, or perhaps other limitations like it? I'm getting you to focus in on one, but maybe there are several. You go, well, I can do like a dozen, you know. That's fine if you want to write down several. But how has this limitation or others forced you to be creative? How has this limitation or others actually forced you to be creative? So for those of you who are dyslexic, what you go, okay, because I'm this, I've had to be creative. I do audiobooks instead of reading. It's easier for me. I grew up with a disability with vision. So fortunately, my parents bought me glasses that corrected it. That was a way for me to solve that limitation for me. What's a way you've been creative? For me, while you're thinking, I'll give you one for me. Growing up most of my life, I was a misfit. I never fit in the tribes that my family grew up in particular religious tribes. Every religious experience I had, they were trying to form me into something else. So I lived in this ever-present state of frustration and limitation, whether I was as someone attending church and serving as a layperson or being on a church staff. And so eventually, one day, my wife and I, about 11 years ago, went, maybe a way to embrace that limitation and go, okay, maybe the fact that we can't move forward with our understanding of God in this way, we will have to go, let's see if we could start a new church. And I would say to you, 11, 12 years ago, if we were in a church scenario that had no limitations, that it was nothing but freedom, they were blowing wind in our sails, they were encouraging us, there's a really good chance today I'd still be serving with students. We were doing youth ministry at the time, and I was teaching at a university and loved it. But it was the greater whole and the limitations that forced us to try and find another path. So what limitations in your life have forced you to create? Now let me ask you this question. how have the limitations in your life produced something in you? And you can go either way. You might go, well, I'll be honest with you. The limitations in my life, I'll tell you what they've produced. Resentment and anger. I'm an angry person because I feel like the obstacles in my life have been too difficult to climb over. Fair. Write that down. Or you go, you know what? The limitations in my life have caused me to go deep, to trust God. I'm closer to God today because of those limitations. I've learned this skill that I otherwise wouldn't have learned if it weren't for this limitation. So do a little reflection on how have limitations affected your life. All right, now let's bring it into present day. What limitations exist today that have you stuck? Bless you. Today, you go, I'm stuck. I'm frustrated. I can't see past this. I can't see around this. It might be your marriage. It might be a difficulty with one of your children. It might be difficulty with your parents. It might be with your vocation. And as a church, we've certainly had a limitation that we've been thwarted in our attempt to find new land or a new property or a place to rent for 3 years, repeatedly. And we had to get creative and go, okay, in these limitations, how do we create? And here we are in another church's space, and I've been able to tell a really beautiful story. I know many of you have, too, to other people in other churches to go, hey, here's two churches that are not in competition with one another but are actually caring for one another. I spoke at Church of the City last Sunday. They invited me to come and speak, and some of you guys know CZ Curtis. He got up, and he was like, hey, you guys, some of you just go hang out at Journey tonight. I mean, that's not normative. I wish it was, but it's not normative in a lot of church worlds. People are very competitive. But so here we, in the midst of our limitation, we've experienced a real beautiful thing in the kingdom of God. But what would you say, today, these limitations have me stuck. You could even frame it like this. What's holding you back from becoming what God has designed you to be? You feel like there's some sense of destiny. I feel in my gut I'm supposed to be a successful songwriter. I feel in my gut like we're meant to hit these financial goals. I feel in my gut that we're supposed to get out of debt. I feel in my gut that our marriage is one day meant to be beautiful. But what's the limitation? What's the obstacle right now, this moment, today? I don't have the job that I want. I don't know how to, I'm just stuck. My wife and I, we don't know how to communicate. I have this thing that keeps this brokenness in me, and I can't get a handle on it. Write it down. What's the thing? Now, let's talk for a minute about art and creativity. Art in its purest form is an expression of the soul. So there's one of our artists put an art piece up today, and when we go to stations, if that's a way you connect visually with God, there's an art piece here, and of course, art is subjective sometimes, right? You go up, and what are you pulling from that art experience? Even as I read the story about Ehud, some of you were immediately drawing connections and going, oh, yeah, I see that, and some of you are like, that's a dumb story. But how does art connect with you? And art is an expression of the soul. And art becomes profound when it exposes or convicts, explains us or inspires us. So let me pose a question. Is it possible that the thing that has you stuck, the limitation that's in your life right now, is meant to be there for you to think creatively and artistically and for you to expose, explain, or inspire someone else through the way you get around that limitation? Shamgar didn't have a sword. He didn't have a rifle. He had a long spear, and somehow he had to make it work. And the implication is he made it work with the power of God. Ehud had no one else who wanted to go with him. He was looked down. He was discriminated against. He was peculiar. But he knew because of his limitation, you could even say his handicap, that the Secret Service didn't check this part of him. And he took advantage of his limitation to be successful in his mission. How might you use the very thing that is limiting you to be an expression of beauty that might even inspire someone else? How might you use a current limitation to express the redemptive nature of God? See, because for some of you, the limitation for you might be in your story. You might go, honestly, like when you guys talk about stories here, I don't like to tell my story because there's this really broken place and I feel shame when I tell that story. There's a lot of regret there. And some of you, because I've been with you, you've pushed through some of that and shared some of that story. And first, it was cathartic for you to actually speak it out, but you also discovered this grace. And then someone else went, well, actually, I can identify, I've struggled with that too. And now the risk and the courage of sharing your story suddenly inspired someone else into an act of courage. And so suddenly the art of storytelling, your story, brought someone hope. One of the things we talk about a lot is sharing the love story of Jesus. Some of you have risked to tell someone who doesn't believe in Jesus Christ, you've risked to tell them about Jesus. You risk being awkward, you risk being embarrassed, you risk not having all the answers. But you told the story of Jesus, and somehow the great redemptive story of Jesus gave someone else hope, and they were drawn to it. And for some of you, you've experienced someone who has actually come to faith in God because you risked telling a story. Here's the thing about sin. A good working definition for sin is to miss the mark. It's to not live up to your potential. Now you might go, well, Jamie, that's the point. This is my tension. I feel like God's calling me to do something. There's like a dream I have, and there's a destiny I feel, but I know there's potential I want to live into, but I can't right now because fill in the blank. And maybe some of the work you're meant to do in that limitation is to say, God, is this a limitation that you have placed on me, a constraint for me to live in a certain tension, for me to understand something about your nature and about your power and about what I can't do on my own? Or is this self-limiting? Is this a sin area in my life? Like, the truth of the matter is I just keep trying to control it. I keep trying to fix it. And the truth is I keep trying to control you, God. And that's the great limit that I haven't surrendered. Perhaps that's the great limitation. And then suddenly when you do, you get around that limit. Things change. And had you not struggled, you might not come to the place where you realize you were powerless. You might just coast. Like, how many people live just kind of a long, boring life? And things are kind of okay. Isn't it good that God keeps us at times from just being okay? Don't you want to live more than an okay life? If every time somebody walks up to you and says, how you doing? You go, fine. Every time. Like, what was it? What if that was your answer for 3 years? How you doing? Fine. Boring. If they go, how you doing? You go, oh, euphoric. You're like, whoa. Wow. I want what you're eating. But I mean, what is that? They go, how you doing? Oh, life sucks right now. It's so hard. Oh, man, what's going on? I've experienced pain. I've experienced triumph. I've experienced failure. I've experienced success. Why? Because I'm going for it. I'm choosing to live, not just exist. And what if the limit in your life is there just to distract you? And there's a lot of focus on the limit right now. This is a place I feel like this is a really good message for me, and I'm like in process. I hadn't worked it all out, but there's a lot of this kind of resonating. I haven't come to conclusions yet, but I'm like, whoa, this is good. Like, what's in my life that's just distracting me? Or what are you afraid of? The Bible says, as a man thinks, so is he. If you are constantly focusing on the negative, you could be living a self-fulfilling prophecy. Ah, life is terrible. Oh, it's never going to work out. Oh, I'm so frustrated. If that's all you ever say. Mark Nepo says this, we are often troubled and blocked by insecurity, that windedness of heart. I think I gave you this quote maybe a year or so. I love this quote. We are often troubled and blocked by insecurity, that windedness of heart. What a great definition for insecurity. Do you feel out of breath in your soul? The windedness of heart. I'm insecure, and so I feel unworthy. Trying to catch my breath internally. The first creative act in Scripture was a spoken word that created contrast. Let there be light. This is God creating. And by the way, it took a certain courage to create. He was creating us with will to make decisions on our own. But what followed was a universe, a planet, creatures upon that planet, as well as natural limitations and rules, laws and restrictions. God created an atmosphere that bears within it a delicate balance of elements and chemicals. And so here's the thing. Sometimes we go, I don't want any limitations. Gravity is both a gift and a limitation. You're like, oh, I wish I could do like what those guys on the moon do. Probably not 24/7. You're probably happy some things stay on the ground. Gravity is a gift and a limitation. God created man and woman, creatures made in likeness, but yet limited in capacity. Men and women are equal in value, but we vary in physiology and proclivity. We carry a common humanity, and yet we also carry distinction. It's not accidental that God formed one from the dust and another from a rib. Embrace the limitations of being a woman. Embrace the limitations of being a man. And if you're in a season of productivity, you go, right now, man, like there's not a lot of limitations. Like things are rocking. Then produce and be grateful for the opportunity to see the fruit of your labor. I mean, just press in. Go for it. If you're in a season of slowing, then choose to enjoy the subtleties of beauty. Like you might just be in a stage in life, or you might be in a season where it's just really slow. Enjoy beauty. Take time to feel the wind on your face. Sketch a leaf. Make a meal. Lie in the grass. Feel the earth. Sit in a snowdrift and absorb the silence. You might get to do that this week. Recognize that each limitation points towards something of value in your life. Let me say that one more time. Recognize that each limitation points towards something of value in your life. Had Ehud not been left-handed, he would not have been able to successfully carry out his mission. Shamgar, not been at least a farmer at some point and known how to work with oxen, he would not have been proficient with an ox goad or a spear. There's some limitation in your life that is there on purpose to bring God glory and for you to experience something perhaps you never would have imagined. 1 Corinthians 1:27. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. Would you pray with me?